This is the Hugo Award-winning SF Signal Podcast. I am your host. My name is Patrick Hester. How's it going, Internet? You been good? It's September, and in Colorado, that means we're ramping up and getting ready and excited for Mile High Con 47. Mile High Con takes place October 23rd through the 25th this year, again at the Hyatt Regency and the Tech Center, which is this cool little area. And you can learn more about it by visiting milehighcon.org. This is my local con. I love it. I love the energy. I love the folks running it and their ability to get the best of the best for programming and as guests of honor, and I put all that on Rose. This year is no different, and I'm absolutely thrilled to have the opportunity to chat with artist guest of honor for Mile High Con 47, Ursula Vernon. Ursula is the author and illustrator of Nurk, Digger, Dragon Breath, and a number of other projects. The daughter of an artist, she spent her youth attempting to rebel and become a scientist, but eventually succumbed to the siren song of paint. Although not before getting a degree in anthropology, because life isn't complete without student loans, right? Her work has been nominated for an Eisner Award, talent deserving of wider recognition, at a number of Webcomics Choice Awards. And Digger won the Hugo Award for graphic fiction in 2012, and I was there to see her get that award, which was awesome. And the Mythopoeic Fantasy Award for Adult Literature in 2013. And in 2015, she won the Nebula Award for Best Short Story with Jackalope Wives. Ursula, thanks for sitting down with me today. How are you doing?
I'm good. Delighted to be here.
I don't usually read bios because I don't do well. I start to try to add words in here and there because that's just the way I am. But that's an awesome bio. You've had a lot of success in the last like 5-6 years.
I'm pretty much expecting to get hit by a bus at any time.
Don't say that.
No, dude, when life goes, I was raised Catholic. If life goes too good, I'm like, yep, gonna end anytime now.
You know what? I was too, and it's hilarious that you put it that way, because I'm always telling, when anything good happens, I always tell people, well, I'm waiting for the other shoe to fall.
Yep.
And it's like, oh, hey, John, we won a Hugo Award. Oh boy, what's going to happen next?
Yes. You know, a tree is going to fall on your car.
Yeah. Something's going to happen. It's like I completely understand what you're talking about. So that reminds me, didn't you like tell your husband the end?
Yes. So Digger was a really long project. It took about 8 years to write, where I was just doing 2 pages a week, week in and week out. I think I took one hiatus to get divorced and move across the country, and even then I started up as soon as I could again. And so I got to a point where there was so much to the story, I started to worry I was going to get hit by a bus. And the last thing I would think would be, oh God, I didn't finish Digger. Part of this was, I think, also inspired by, you remember when Stephen King was writing The Dark Tower and then he got hit by a car and everyone was like, now we're never going to know how The Dark Tower ends. Mm-hmm, yep. Also, we're very sorry for you, Mr. King, but seriously, we're never. And now we're starting to get that with George R. R. Martin. People are like, finish the damn series. And I certainly have nothing like the readership of either of those gentlemen, but I was starting to get this twitch of, oh, what if something happens to me and then no one will know how it ends. So, and this weighed on me, and finally, one day I could not take it anymore, and I ambushed my my then boyfriend, now husband, in the shower and said, I have to tell you how it ends. And he's like, right now? Like, yes, right now. And he stood there in the shower, and I told him the entire end of the plot. And it still had about 2 years to run, and there was at least one sort of tragic thing that happened, and he was like, oh, okay. And to his eternal credit, and I always want to give him credit for this because it was hard, people would come up to us at cons and say how much they were enjoying it, however much they liked, you know, X or Y or Z, and he would know what was going to happen, and he never breathed a word to any of them.
Wow.
Which was above and beyond the call of duty, really.
That is awesome, though. Yeah. And, you know, it is a thing, and it is something with George R. Martin. I mean, it happened to Robert Jordan. Right?
Yeah.
He had to tell someone else. He had to write the notes out. So it is a thing, but hopefully not something that'll ever happen. Let's talk about Digger for a second, because this is the one. I love the picture that you had with him holding her holding the Hugo.
Oh yes, a friend of mine did that for me, actually. Yeah.
Oh really? Okay, yeah. I didn't know that.
Yeah.
I was like, I don't know what this is, but I guess you could knock someone out if you hit him over the head with it.
Yep. It's a comic about a wombat, which is probably the most basic and uninformative thing I can say about it.
Well, and forgive me, it's been a long time since Digger, it was a she.
Yes, Digger, yeah, Digger's a she.
I thought so. Okay.
Although, because she had very few secondary sexual characteristics, we would go, and I never bothered to use pronouns, because it's not like you often say
sure
to someone you're talking to, hello, Patrick, who is a male, you know, thing. So we got over 100 pages in before somebody mentioned in passing that Digger was female, and I had people going, wait, what? Really? And it was... So I was actually kind of proud of that. It was a comic where most of the cast was actually female, and it didn't matter
right.
that they were, because they were saving the world, and that was important, and it wasn't about that fact. So it was nice.
I do that to my critique group all the time. I hand them stories with no pronouns, and I let them try to decide.
Yep. Yep.
And they always get to the end of the story and they're like, "Oh, crap. He did it to us again."
Yeah, I just sold one to Murr, actually,
all right.
A few weeks ago, and which is all first-person sort of stream of consciousness. At the end, she's like, there are no gender markers in this. They are the characters referred to as Doctor when they're referred to at all. I'm like, oh, yeah, I guess they are.
I love that, though. It's fun.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
It lets the reader just use their own imagination.
The other funny thing in Digger was one of the characters literally has no gender, is a animate talking shadow, and called the Shadow Child, and is aggressively ungendered. It is not a no gender queer things. It is a demon. It's an it, and it is fine with being an it. And everyone projected their own gender on it. Whenever people talk about it, they would start calling her or him or whatever. And it almost about 90% of the time it mapped to the person talking's gender, which I found sort of interesting.
And so you did eventually finish Digger.
I did. Thank God. Yes. I finished it. I was not hit by a bus. I did not, hurtle off a bridge and go or anything like that. So I finished it. Put out Sofa Wolf Press, who did the print versions, put out a big omnibus edition, and it won a Hugo, as you mentioned, which was really unexpected and kind of wild, because I didn't actually know at the time they gave Hugos for graphic stories. Mm-hmm. And I got the email while I was helping my father and stepmother move from Arizona to Georgia. So I was like 3 days into this horribly long road trip across Texas. Ugh. Where we were part of a convoy, and I was driving a dog grooming van full of there was a safe full of money. There were guns. This is all legit. Okay. There were licenses for the guns. My dad is a hunter. And I had a cat in a carrier named the Cop, and a whole bunch of just odds and ends stuffed in the back of this dog grooming van. And I get this email, hi, you've been nominated for a Hugo. I'm like, oh yeah, right. I tossed it in the spam file. And I was like, wait, hang on. That was an oddly specific piece of spam. And wait, if this is a phishing scheme, nobody targets writers. We don't have money. Let me go get that back out and look. And I looked at it, and I was like, and I Googled the name of the person sending it to me, and they looked like a real person in Chicago. And I was like, okay, I can't deal with this. So I called my husband, was like, make us get us like a rent a hotel, get tickets, do something. I can't deal with this right now. Did I mention I am driving a grooming van full of guns? And so they were unloaded, for the record. So anyway,
that across was the panhandle?
No, across the main body.
Oh my goodness!
Yeah, we were in Texas for 4 days.
Oh wow! Yeah.
I think we hit Mississippi, and we realized we'd been going so slowly that we were not going to get to the storage unit on time to get unloaded. So since I was the fastest vehicle. Everyone else was driving like, motorhomes and Penske trucks. I had to drive like super fast across, as fast as dog grooming van will go, across the rest of the South to get to Georgia to, put down deposits on stuff. So it was an exciting adventure.
When I had to make a similar drive from California to Tennessee,
Oh, that's a long one.
My uncle, who's from Arkansas, told me, he said, there's only two states you don't want to speed in. And I said, okay. He says, Texas and Arkansas. He said, because they will pull you over.
The Texas has the like...
daytime, nighttime speeds?
Yeah. And we got on another case when I had to cross Texas. I've driven across Texas the long way so many times. I really, no offense to Texas, but I think that state is trying to kill me. we were driving all night with a friend of mine, and she was, I don't know how fast she was going. I had just fallen asleep. The blue lights go on. She's like, I could try to get out of this ticket by being sexy. No. No, it's 3 a.m. Just give me the ticket. I don't care anymore.
Oh, so. Boy. So you got the nom, and then you got the award, which is awesome.
Yes.
And but you didn't rest on your laurels. You just kept going.
Well, if I rest on my laurels, I don't think I know how to rest on my laurels. No, that's not true. I am convinced at all times that I am in the act of resting on my laurels, and then I feel guilty. So I'm like, oh god, I didn't work on, you know, I didn't invent anything epic or amazing this week. I have not written a book. I have not finished a book in 3 months. Clearly I am stagnating, and I will be washed up, and they will never hear from me again.
So the cool thing for our listeners is, if they want to read a really cool story, they can go out and they can get all of Digger. From front to back, they can get it. What about NERC?
NERC was my first children's book, and this was one of the people ask, how do you get into children's books? And I tell them, I don't know. There was how I got into children's books, which no one I think should try or could probably duplicate, which was that a friend of mine who's a romance author told a funny story about her artist friend reading a romance novel at a dinner. And there was an agent sitting next to her who said, oh, does she do graphic novels? Those are really hot these days. And I acquired an agent sort of that way. That is not a normal way to get one. The agent had looked at a bunch of my art, said, this is really cute. This would make good children's books. Do you think you could write a children's book? And I said, sure. That seems like a thing I could do. She said, okay, how long will it take? And the problem was that I was used to working on art deadlines because I was an illustrator, you know, professionally. And I was like, oh, crap. Well, how long does it? So I said, can I have 8 weeks or can I have 6 weeks? Because that's a standard art deadline. And she said, why don't you take 8? And it did not occur to me this was a very short period of time to write a children's book, but it was. But nevertheless, I sat down and wrote NERC in 6 weeks, and that way I figured I'd have 2 weeks for edits, and in case she hated it. And again, this is not normal, but she sold it right away, and it was a fun little book about a shrew. You can still find copies. Unfortunately, it was orphaned twice in production, which very rarely happens to a book quite so often in a row. And but I can't complain because the second editor went off to Penguin and bought Dragon Breath, which is the long-running series that I followed with, which is going up to the final and 11th volume is coming out in January. So
talk about Dragon Breath.
Oh, yes. Dragon Breath it's this 8 to 12 is sort of the age range, although it goes a lot lower if you've got solid readers. It's like half comic book and half chapter book. Which, if you've seen like Diary of a Wimpy Kid or something like that, that was super popular at the time, still kind of is. It's about a little dragon who goes to a school for reptiles and amphibians and his best friend's an iguana. And nobody knows he's really a dragon. They think he's like one of those lizards that are called dragons, like Komodo dragons or water dragons or whatever. And he can't breathe fire yet, and so he has these very strange magical adventures, and the town has a ridiculous bus system that will take you to, like, the Sargasso Sea or mythical Japan, or there was one brief shot in one of the books where they're in Tijuana. I was not allowed to pursue that beyond the one panel. So my editors let me get away with a lot as long as I don't push it.
That's still awesome.
Oh, I was pleased. I sneak a lot of what I realized about doing children's books early on, when I would do public events and parents would come up and say, "My son loves your books. We read them every night." They would look at me and I would be like, "Oh, I don't know if we are friends." So I started putting in the occasional joke for adults. There's actually a passage at the beginning of there's a book called Nightmare of the Iguana, which is about takes place in Wendell the Iguana's nightmares. And it starts, he wakes up from a dream screaming, "There are four lights." And I was very proud of that. I don't think my editor actually watched Star Trek because she let me get away with it.
Well, you have to have fun, though.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely.
That's awesome. So I'm trying to describe your art style. You do some really cool, detailed, I want to say adult kind of stuff. And then you also, you kind of mix it with this whimsical stuff.
Yeah.
I don't know how else to, and it's funny because I read a graphic novel column for Kirkus Reviews, and I'm describing art as stuff.
It's cool that you write a graphic novel column for Kirkus, though.
Yeah.
Kirkus is badass. I am indebted to Kirkus. They keep giving me positive reviews, and the thing with Kirkus is when they give you a negative review, as you well know, they savage you. So I feel like I'm riding a tiger. Every time one comes out, I'm like, all right, still on the tiger. Sooner or later, gonna fall off the tiger, then it's just gonna be blood everywhere. I believe Kirkus is aware of its reputation, so I'm not telling you anything you don't know. Yeah, it's for the children's books, because I do like 150 illustrations per book and I only get about 3 months to do the art, they have to be really simplified line drawings. For Digger and just when I feel like painting, I can get a little more complicated. What I learned doing Digger is that you can sweat and slave over a background for hours and people will comment on what's in the word balloon. And yeah. Yeah, and so sometimes you do it anyway just to prove to yourself that you can. Sure. That, you know, I am still a brilliant artist. I can still do this. Oh, God. But a lot of times what people want is the plot to move along, not necessarily to sit and gaze at the background. I also learned that if you're drawing a library and if you put names on the spines of the books, people will read every single name on the spine and discuss how it got there.
Yeah.
I don't know why.
I blame mainstream comics for that. Because I don't know if you've ever done this before, but if you search Easter eggs in comics.
Oh, yeah. I haven't searched for that.
Yeah, you will find so many Easter eggs. It's like you didn't realize that Popeye olive oil and Bluto appeared in that issue of Spider-Man.
Yep.
Or yep. That, I don't know.
Sandman is basically made of Easter eggs.
Yeah. So I think that's why people do that, especially comic book fans. We're kind of conditioned to, oh, what's in the background? Wait a minute. There's a lot of stuff going on in here. Is there someone else? Should I be looking for Superman in this comic? You know, and that just kind of sort of happens. So,
well, and part of that, too, is when you catch it, it's like an in-joke and you feel smart for having caught it. So it's very rewarding, you know, when you go, wait a minute, I know that.
Or in my case, I look it up online, find out that something was in a comic that I read, and then feel ridiculously stupid because I didn't even notice it.
Well, there's a dark side.
So I'm curious, are you gonna have any art on display at Mile High Con?
Yes, I'm the artist guest, so they tend to like you to bring something along. Mm-hmm. I don't do as many originals these days, so I'll have a smaller selection of those, but I'll have a bunch of prints and a couple of drawings of like the little pencils of Harriet and Danny. Harriet is the character from Hamster Princess, and Danny Dragon Breath and whatnot, and some limited edition prints of the sort of stuff that I do when I'm like, I am going to do a painting, and it will be amazing, or at least I will try, and it doesn't have to be done in 5 minutes so that I can get 150 of them done.
So that leads me to two questions that I want to ask. So first off, what do you use to draw? What medium do you use? Are you a Photoshop tablet kind of person? Are you actually doing canvas and paints? Are you doing some sort of hybrid?
99% of the time I'm digital. Certainly for the Dragon Breath and the Hamster books, and for Digger, it was all digital, because when you have to move things around so much and fit it into panels, it's just a lot easier.
Sure.
And since I pretty much learned to draw on a tablet, ironically, back in the dark ages, before Photoshop, when what we had was something called Dabbler.
Oh, wow.
And on an Amiga 500, where I had Deluxe Paint 3. state of the art.
I've told people I started computers on a Mac 2CX with Illustrator and Aldus PageMaker.
Wow, I remember PageMaker.
And all my art, because I had black and white TIFFs of things that we sold, because I was working for my uncle at the time, and it was little pictures of everything that was like little what they call line art.
Yep.
And the entire catalog fit on a floppy.
Wow.
Yeah. that's telling my age right there.
Yeah. Dude, I lost a bunch of art because it was on a zip disk.
Yeah, I you know what? I actually have zip disks here in the super secret layer, underground layer of the Functional Nerds. And I don't have a zip drive anymore, but I'm keeping the disks because I know there's stuff on there that I might want someday, even though I have no way of reading the disks, because that's just the way my brain works.
Yep. Yeah, I gave up. They're probably in a box somewhere, you know, or at Goodwill, and someone is going to find them. But yeah. That is one difficulty with being mostly digital. If I didn't put it online, it does not exist anymore.
Yep.
So many, many old paintings were lost. But honestly, given the quality of them, I am still at the point where I don't feel bad about that.
They were your trunk novels. Got it.
Yeah. Well, I had a couple trunk novels get lost too, but it's for the best.
So you do mostly digital, which is cool. And I'm curious, how does it work with the art shows at cons? I'm just wondering, like, I know that they can sell your art for you, if I'm not mistaken. And so how does that whole thing work?
I sell prints of digital art. I have a high-end art printer that
that's cool.
will do like up to 13x19, and so I run prints off on that. It is the only piece of machinery on earth that I know how to use. I can't change my own oil, but by God, if the ink breaks on that, I can service that machine. So
do you are you printing a bunch of stuff and bringing it?
Mostly, yeah. Okay. And then I bring along a couple originals too, because there is a chunk of collectors who just really want an original.
Sure.
And I don't have as much time as I used to, but I like bringing some of those along just for people who really want to have something like that. And yeah, you mat them up, you frame them if need be. You take. I have a very large oversized suitcase that I pay excessive amounts to bring along, and
Gotcha. So if someone is coming to an art show and you're going to be displaying, they have a shot at getting some original, but also some prints.
Yep.
If they wanted to, can they go to UrsulaVernon.com and like order art from you?
They would want to go to Red Wombat Studio. UrsulaVernon.com is where all the kids' books funnel through. So it's mostly for kids' books, which is actually a story in and of itself. Back when I did the very first book, I had UrsulaVernon.com, of course. And when NERC came out, I thought that I had a month before the book came out to create a new website and that was kid-friendly and all. Because I'd been an illustrator, so, you know, and I had been working on RPG manuals, so I had an entire website that was basically my art portfolio and places to sell prints, and some of them were not necessarily small child friendly. And Amazon released the book a month early.
Oh, no.
And all of a sudden, I was like, oh, God, oh, God. And the thing is, my website, they would put UrsulaVernon.com in the back under my author name and bio. And my another reason that I married my current husband is because he stayed up all night coding a new website basically from scratch, because, you know, it's what he does. And it was like 4 a.m. He was typing faster than I could read off the screen and got everything funneled and safe and good looking. And it was like, you are amazing.
Marry me.
Yes. That was a few years later, but yes, yes.
So Red Wombat Studios, where people can go and they can purchase prints. Yep. and original art?
The few originals I have, yes. Okay. I put very few originals on there anymore because I need them for art shows.
Sure.
Now.
Can people commission art?
Not easily. Okay. The problem is that my schedule is so brutal that I don't really take commissions anymore because I'm already on the hook for, you know, 300 illustrations for the next 2 books kind of thing. And so I just, I'm like, I could do it, but it will be 2020 before you get your piece. And then I'll feel like very guilty and you'll have forgotten about it.
Well, I'm running out of time, so I don't want to forget to ask you about T. Kingfisher.
Yes, in my copious spare time, I write for adults as well. And so I do it under the pen name T. Kingfisher because there is a children's books. If you, particularly since mine are aimed towards the more reluctant reader set, you get parents who are like, my kid will read your books. Therefore, I will go to Amazon and order every single thing you have ever written for
right.
my child.
Yes.
And this is commendable. But at the same time, it means that I cannot write my weird retelling of Bluebeard under my own name.
Right, you're like Bob Saget. You want to go on HBO and say the F word.
Yes, exactly. Or I want to, you know, dismember people in text, not really.
Sure.
I actually left a note on one of the recent children's books where my editor was like, no, this is too gory. You're not allowed to cut people's tongues out in a book for 8-year-olds. And I'm like, I am just not allowed to dismember anybody. We have long conversations in the little comments section on the Word documents. She was like, sorry, Ursula, but no. So that I can go and cut people's tongues out if the story requires it, I write under the name T. Kingfisher. I have a novella out that is a sort of silly fantasy one about goblins. I have 2 somewhat darker fairy tale retellings. One is called Bryony and Roses, which is about which is a Beauty and the Beast story. And the other one is, in fact, a retelling of Bluebeard called The Seventh Bride. And it will be re-released from 47 North in November, shortly after Mile High Con. Because I had self-published it, and then Amazon came and was like, we wish to purchase this. And I was like, oh, okay, how did you know it existed? And I'm not saying that they steepled their fingers and looked at me and said, we have our ways, but it kind of felt like the people who have occasionally been in conference rooms say that there are algorithms that can see things selling and tell them when a thing is likely to be worth their while.
Nice.
So apparently it triggered that somehow. So I was happy.
So someone turned and said, Smithers, buy that.
Yes. Yeah. Well, I think it was more Smithers. Look at that. It's doing something. And the very nice people at 47 North who have been fantastic to work with, much as we enjoy giving Amazon crap about being, you know, diabolical, they were just a joy to work with. She was looking for something sort of Guillermo del Toro-esque and decided that this weird story with a hedgehog and 7 wives and golems and whatnot was what she was looking for. So I was thrilled.
Interesting.
So we'll see how it goes.
Yeah. So congratulations on that. That's awesome.
Oh, yeah, yeah. It's, well, hybrid publishing is apparently the wave of the future, I am told.
It is. It is. And actually, as we're recording this, yesterday I was at I was invited to a romance writers, was it Colorado Romance Writers business meeting where they wanted me to talk to them about podcasting.
Yep.
And I have to tell you, the romance writers are on top of this stuff.
Oh, romance writer. It is a business. And they are, to get anywhere, you have to be just ruthless business people and romance. It is not a you get to sit in the room and they shove food and checks under the door profession.
There were 30 ladies in this room, and they all had business plans. And they had, for every book, they have a book launch plan.
Wow.
Marketing plan. I mean, I was just like, wow. And then, and there's no looking down your nose at indie publishing. It was, oh yeah, I'm doing this traditionally, and I'm doing this indie, and I'm doing this and this and this and this and this. It's like, wow, they're just all over it.
Yeah. It's if I release this in this way, then it can piggyback on the success of this other one. And when this comes out in trade, I will self-publish these in the following 2 months. So to get the bump
they're watching what the traditional publishers are publishing and when, and if they have something that's of a similar vein and let's say, I know it's a cliche, but let's say, there's a guy in a kilt on the cover. Oh, I have a guy in a kilt on the cover. So I'm going to release my guy in the kilt with the kilt on the cover the same day as, Harlequin is releasing theirs. And then when all these people are searching for guy in a kilt, they're going to find mine too.
Yep. Cover design, similar thing. The current trend is we cut off the top of the head and have the text here. All right, we'll do that.
Yep.
The successful ones really follow the market very closely on that, because it's a huge and cutthroat field, and it moves a lot of product.
It's crazy. Yeah. It's crazy, crazy. So obviously I've avoided talking a little bit about your schedule at Mile High Con, because we don't have a schedule yet, but that's just because there's so many moving pieces. They don't always get them out as early as we're recording this, but that's fine. But we know that you're the artist guest of honor, so you're going to be doing some guest of honor stuff. Usually there's like a big guest of honor panel, there's Q&A sessions. I believe at some point you have to buy everybody a drink in the bar. I think that's just the way it works.
Yes, I've been instructed to bring money.
I might be kidding. are you a cosplayer? Do you like costumes or anything like that?
I admire them in the method of one who cannot do it. I am always very impressed by good ones, but I don't cosplay myself because I never learned to sew. But I believe I will probably be around the masquerade being very impressed.
Yeah, I was going to say that there's not a huge cosplay contingent at Mile High Con, but there are people walking around in costumes, and usually the masquerade is the big deal. So that's where all the people in costumes come. There's also typically the dealer room is really good about finding things, books that the guests of honor have published, and selling them in the dealer room.
Excellent.
So you'll probably see a lot of your stuff there, which is awesome.
That's what we like to hear.
if people have already got some of your stuff, can they come up to you and say, hey, will you sign this for me?
Oh, heavens, yes. Anytime. Anything you want signed. I will even sign other people's books if they're friends of mine. but I definitely, if you have anything of mine you want it signed, if you want a tiny doodle of a wombat signed, I would be delighted. Bring a sketchbook or something. I will draw you a tiny wombat and sign it. Whatever.
That's awesome. Well, it's funny. I just flew to, you mentioned signing other people's books. I flew to Boston for a marketing conference this last week. And I keep joking, it was wicked smart. But I went there, and I've always seen when authors are traveling that one of the things they like to do is find an airport bookstore, find their books, and then sign them and leave them there. Right, as Easter eggs, and tell people, hey, I signed some books at this airport. You should look for them, right?
Oh,
and,
yeah.
And I've always thought that was cool, and I wanted to get in on that. So I found some Chuck Wendig books, and I signed them as Sam Sykes.
Disturbingly plausible.
And in there, I just put, Sam Sykes, buy my book.
Yep. That is exactly what would happen.
Well, Ursula, this has been a wonderful conversation. Unfortunately, I'm totally out of time with you.
All right.
So what I want to do is, is there anything else you want our listeners to know about before I let you go?
You can find the T. Kingfisher books at tkingfisher.com. It will have links to all the various places you can buy the ebooks. I My Hamster Princess Book One, Harriet the Invincible, just came out. And I like mojitos. I think that covers pretty much everything of any interest about me. You can follow me on Twitter at Ursula V. There will be lots of close-up photos of bugs, so don't do it if you're sensitive to that.
And then how many websites do you have?
Too many. Let's see. Red Wombat Studio, Ursula Vernon, T. Kingfisher. I think that's it, but I'm also, you know, Twitter, Tumblr. Oh, and I have a live journal, Ursula V. Cool. Live journal.
And
yeah.
And how often can you be found at Chapel Hill Comics?
Less often than I would like to be found there on the grounds that they have a lot of my money already. But I certainly like to go out that way whenever I get a chance. But the other thing that stops me most is that driving in Chapel Hill is nightmarish and parking is worse.
Yeah, so. I used to have to travel there, so I do understand.
Yes.
Alrighty, well, thank you for coming on, and I can't wait to meet you in person at Mile High Con.
Looking forward to it.
Thank you for listening to the Hugo Award-winning SF Signal podcast. Your host is Patrick Hester, an author, a blogger, and a functional nerd. His website is www.atfmb.com, which stands for All Things From My Brain. ATFMB is also his Twitter handle and where you can find him on Facebook. Our podcast is available for download every week at sfsignal.com or via iTunes. Look for the links to subscribe in the sidebar at sfsignal.com or search SF Signal in iTunes. If you enjoyed this podcast, please tell your friends and have them tell their friends, and so on, and so on. Visit the Hugo Award-winning sfsignal.com for all of your speculative fiction needs. John D. and the SF Signal regulars offer up new content every day, from weekly mind melds featuring your favorite authors, editors, and artists from the SF&F field, to book reviews, original articles and essays, fiction deals, movie reviews, videos, links and roundup posts, and more. Click the RSS button in the sidebar of your browser to ensure you never miss a post. The SF Signal podcast is powered by the Functional Nerds.
Romeo, Romeo, wherefore art thou, Romeo?
Angry robot.
It's like talking to a child.
Magic Wooey.
Wah, wah. Thinking and crap.
I don't even know what the horseman is.
And scene, you bastard.